Now that the political battle over Australian school funding has been put to rest, many are keen to evaluate the applied results over time of this Gonski model on our students from here on in. Australia is slipping behind in international rankings, I'm sure you've heard. But the whole method of assessing this is provoking much interest too, beyond Australia. Take Lucy Crean, for instance. She was a hard-working science teacher in London, preparing her lessons, chasing up homework, ploughing through the curriculum. But her efforts weren't translating into academic success for her charges, and she began to wonder what really was different in these top-performing PISA countries, that organisation that tests a global sample of 15-year-olds in maths, science and reading, and is increasingly influencing educational policy around the world. So Lucy set off on an odyssey through Canada, Finland, Japan, Singapore and Shanghai. In each of these countries, she immersed herself in the classrooms, trying to understand deeply educational success. I'll let Lucy take us through it further. She has assembled her work in Cleverlands, the secrets behind the success of the world's educational superpowers. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great idea, I must say, to experience all these education systems firsthand. How did you choose the countries from the list of top performers?
Well, actually, to be honest, my original list included 8 countries. I was going to go to 8 of the top performing systems in the world, according to the Programme for International Student Assessment. And in the end, I thought I should have a balance. So went to countries from a few different continents rather than going to mainly East Asian countries.
And I gather you wanted teacher-to-teacher contact. You avoided going through sort of high-level government or department channels. So you didn't want to just be placed in model schools.
Exactly. I wanted to get an understanding of what your average school was like in as far as that is a thing that actually exists.
Now, the PISA tests, which we've become very aware of, they're interesting, aren't they? Because on the one hand, they're an important measure of education systems. But as everyone knows, there's more to education than test results. And I suppose, am I reading you correctly, that's the space you're exploring?
Actually, no. I was interested in why these countries did so well in those tests. I think that while obviously education is much more to do with just tests, I think that it's important that children are able to read, to do maths, to use their science and apply that. So I was interested in why they did as well as they did. But while going actually spending time in schools, I was also looking to see what were the side effects of that and were they able to focus on other things as well.
Interesting. So, I mean, we're close to Asia, obviously, here in Australia, which has scored so very well. And we have a large migrant community, so we're always comparing ourselves with those countries. But from what you're writing, perhaps we have more in common with multicultural Canada. What I'm really getting at, I suppose, is the comparing and contrasting is what seems to me to be a challenging thing to do.
I think that while a lot of people will say, well, actually, there's not much you can learn from these countries because they're entirely monocultural. For example, Finland, certainly Japan as well, they do have mainly monocultural societies. But I do think there are some general principles that we can draw out from these countries, and there are things that we can learn from them if we learn intelligently. The problem often is that sometimes politicians will cherry pick a particular idea and just plonk it from one country to another. I think if you look at why they're doing as well as they are, in a bigger sense and look at the complex picture, you are able to learn some things.
Interesting. And I mean, you start your chapter on Singapore, for instance, with a quote from Lee Kuan Yew, the founding prime minister, and a little about your own first experience there. The quote reads, "You marry a non-graduate, you're going to have problems. Some children are bright, some not bright." And then you write, "My first educational encounter in Singapore was with a small Muslim lady at passport control at Changi. 'Why have you come to Singapore?' she asked. 'I'm researching the world's best education systems.' She raised one eyebrow and pursed her lips. 'You think Singapore has the world's best education system? No la, we put too much, low lady, we put too much pressure on kids too young.'" So, you know, that was a bit of a surprise.
Yes and no, in the sense that there are these stereotypes of East Asian countries in particular having very, very hardworking children. And I think that is certainly the case. And it was the same in Shanghai, in China, that I went to as well. Children are working very long hours, working on the weekends. There's a huge amount of pressure put on them to pass those exams.
Yes, and we've done stories before on the significant, small but significant numbers of people from some of those Confucian-based societies who are sending their children away out of those pressures into Western education systems. But you did go to Finland, a nation much admired for both good results and a more relaxed attitude. I was amazed to read in your book that there are no academic selective schools there. Here's a little from a young student called Emma reflecting on this, and you quote her. "It can be rather annoying if you're one of the nerdy kids. In English, I was always the first one ready, and it would just mean more work for me, just like, oh, okay, you're done. Now, just do the other questions too. Yeah, and they would often ask me to help the other kids too." And then later, you quote a teacher who says, "It's all okay that bright kids will always learn." A lot of Australians might find that refreshing or challenging. Where do you stand?
I think that was probably my main takeaway from Finland in terms of what they could possibly work on is stretching those brighter children. But I think maybe they've got it the right way round, in that what Finland do is they have additional teachers, they employ additional teachers in schools to work with students that need an extra push, of the students that are not doing so well and need extra support. And their focus, firstly, is on making that all children are accessing the curriculum before it is on pushing children who are already doing well to do even further. Of course, in an ideal world, you would do both. But I think some countries might be focused too far the other way around and actually say, well, you know, these students are struggling, let's put them in a different class, they can do easier work, that's all they can manage. And actually what came across all of the countries I went to, remarkably, of the five countries I went to, four of them had mixed ability classes all the way up to 15 or 16, was that they did have these high expectations of all of the children, that all of them could reach a high academic standard.
And look, just quickly before I leave Finland, because I have actually heard teachers say to me, the Finnish make sure, mind you, you're suggesting it's not true, that they keep out the children who don't go to these tests if they're really falling down, falling through the cracks. Did you find that?
I wasn't there when they actually sat the tests. But if you look at the OECD figures, Finland don't exclude more children from these tests than any other. There are quite strict rules from the OECD that you can only exclude 5% of the student population from these tests based on special need. So no more than any other country.
On Saturday Extra, I'm Geraldine Dugan. Lucy Crean's my guest. She's a teacher who decided to explore firsthand the education systems of the top-performing countries we read about. And her book that resulted from this is very readable. It's called Cleverlands. So what about some of the broader themes, like class size, for instance? Just last month, the OECD's Andreas Schleicher told Fairfax Media that Australia should think harder about increasing class size and freeing up teachers. What do you think about that?
It's counterintuitive, isn't it? But I do agree, actually. Certainly, there are two different ways of trying to improve educational quality. One would be, which has been the traditional way, I suppose, is to try and decrease class size so that the teacher can give more individual attention to each student. The alternative approach, which is taken in the East Asian countries in particular, is by having a bigger class, it actually means that you can be more picky about which teachers are teaching them. So if you have a very high quality teacher, even if they have a bigger class, and they have time after the class to help individual students, that actually could be better than having more teachers and therefore smaller class sizes, but a lower quality of teacher with those students.
And teacher quality here in Australia is certainly the big new focus, and there are a number of measures in place now to raise the standard. What were your thoughts about attitudes to the profession of teaching in the countries you visited?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly higher. Well, it's not so bad in the UK where I come from, but it was high. So teachers were treated with respect, and I think certainly in some cases that is just historical luck or a matter of the culture. So in Finland, for example, teachers have been afforded respect since they were seen as bastions of Finnishness. So making sure that the students remained Finnish in the face of Russian and Swedish occupation, and that has persisted. But in order for it to persist, and this is the same in the East Asian cultures, they are very selective. So the reason that teachers are respected is because it's a difficult profession to enter, and they then have a lot of training. You know, you do 5 years as a teacher in Finland, 5 years teacher training. So you're respected because you're a knowledge worker. It's a true profession. It's not a case that anyone with a degree can just come in with a winning personality and teach. You really have to know your stuff.
Do you know, I've never heard anybody talk about that question about identity and Finnishness in terms of the teachings. That's very interesting, isn't it? Of all the countries you visited for your book, I wonder really, Lucy, if you were in a position to choose for one for your children, which country would it be?
It would be Canada. I don't have children yet. I don't know what my children will be like. And I think Canada is somewhere that does cater for all children, both those who are struggling, so they have the same approach as Finland in terms of having those additional teachers to support children, that they also do the same for the brighter children. Just to clarify, they're not taking them out and putting them in different classes permanently, but they are pulling them out in small groups and giving that extra support every now and then. They also, as I was saying earlier, have a much broader idea about what education is for, and they really put a lot of time and resource into that extracurricular side of things as well.
And they'd sit about where on these big tests scores? They were about fifth or sixth, I think you said, did you?
No, actually lower than that now. We're kind of 12th, 13th.
Oh, right. Okay.
So not as well. I mean, the top six spots are dominated by East Asian countries. Mm-hmm. And it depends on the subject, of course.
So look, it's quite a simplistic question, but it is a logical one, and it's sort of my summary question to ask you what works. Could you identify any principles that you think make up an excellent education system?
I can. So to start with, I think it's important to prepare children for school properly, not to start them too young and expect them to have high academic expectations of them at a young age. Make sure they have the basis, make sure that they are socially ready for school, give them educational and socially focused preschool with qualified teachers before they start. Start them at age 6 or 7. Once they do start, have a mastery-based curriculum. So what I mean by that is what certainly these East Asian cultures do is have less in the curriculum, but spend more time on each concept. So it means the children really get to grips with something before they move on, rather than rushing over a whole greater number of things. Make sure that your teachers are highly qualified and trained. And you can either do that by front-loading that and giving them a longer period of teacher training initially, or having some kind of teacher career structure that requires teachers to continue doing accredited professional development throughout their career as they progress. Hold schools accountable. Make sure that you're tracking how schools are doing in terms of student results. But the way that you use those is very important, that they're used to support schools to improve rather than sanction them. I think something that you see in the UK and in the US is while school data is generated, sometimes that is used to punish schools that aren't doing well, which is not necessarily the most productive way of improving them.
Well, Lucy, I think you've really performed a service for us all. Thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Lucy Crehan has put all this together in Cleverlands, C-R-E-H-A-N, Cleverlands. It's published by Unbound.